The following sermon was delivered by Rabbi Joshua Davidson on Friday, November 22nd, 2013.
You are visiting our congregation for the first time. We bid you a warm welcome. Temple Emmanuel is a house of prayer for all people, and all who would worship with us in peace are most welcome in this house of God. Wherever you are from, whenever you are in the neighborhood, we hope you will consider this congregation to be your home. This week's parasha is Vayeshev. Our rabbinic intern, Alexis Pinsky, will teach on it tomorrow morning at 9:15, and Rabbi Zeidman will preach on it at 10:30. I, though, am going to focus my brief remarks this evening on the tragic anniversary we are marking today, and the festival of Hanukkah, which begins on Wednesday night. In his memoir, Fear No Evil, Anatoly, now Natan Sharansky, recalls the nearing of Hanukkah in the Soviet Gulag. The holiday was approaching, he writes. At the time, I was the only Jew in the prison zone. But when I explained that Hanukkah was a holiday of national freedom, of returning to one's own culture in the face of forced assimilation, my friends decided to celebrate it with me. They even made me a wooden menorah, decorated it, and found some candles. In the evening, I lit the first candle and recited a prayer that I had composed. Tea was poured, and I began to describe the heroic struggle of the Maccabees to save their people from slavery. For each prisoner who was listening, the story had its own personal meaning. At one point, the duty officer appeared in the barracks. He made a list of all those present, but did not interfere. On each of the subsequent evenings, I took out my menorah, lit the candles, and recited the appropriate blessing. Then I blew out the candles, as I didn't have any extras. Gravilyuk, the collaborator whose bunk was across from mine, watched and occasionally grumbled. Look at him. He made himself a synagogue. And what if there's a fire? On the sixth night of Hanukkah, the authorities confiscated my menorah with all my candles. I ran to the duty officer to find out what had happened. The candlesticks were made from state materials, he said. This is illegal. You could be punished for this alone. And the other prisoners are complaining. They're afraid you'll start a fire. I began to insist. In 2 days, Hanukkah will be over, and then I'll return this state property to you. Now, however, this looks like an attempt to deny me the opportunity of celebrating Jewish holidays. The duty officer began hesitating. Then he phoned his superior and got his answer. A camp is not a synagogue. We won't permit Sharansky to pray here. I was surprised by the bluntness of that remark and immediately declared a hunger strike. In a statement to the authorities, I protested against the violation of my national and religious rights and against KGB interference in my personal life. 2 days later, I was summoned to Major Osen's office. Osen pulled a benevolent smile over his face as he tried to talk me out of my hunger strike. He promised to see to it personally that in the future nobody would hinder me from praying, and that this should not be a concern of the KGB. Then what's the problem, I said. Give me back the menorah. Tonight is the last evening of Hanukkah. Let me celebrate it now, and I shall end the hunger strike. What's a menorah? He asked. I was seized by an amusing idea. Listen, I said, I'm sure you have the menorah somewhere. It's very important to me to celebrate the last night of Hanukkah. Why not let me do it here and now, together with you? You'll give me the menorah, I'll light the candles and say the prayer, and I'll end the hunger strike. Osen thought it over, and promptly the confiscated menorah appeared from his desk. He summoned Gravilyuk, who was on duty in the office, to bring a large candle. I need 8 candles, I said. Then Osen took out a handsome inlaid pocket knife and deftly cut me 8 candles. I arranged the candles and went to the coat rack for my hat, explaining to Osen that during the prayer you must stand with your head covered and at the end say, Amen. He put on his major's hat and stood. I lit the candles and recited my own prayer. Blessed are you, Adonai, for allowing me to rejoice on this day of Hanukkah, the holiday of our liberation, the holiday of our return to the way of our fathers. Blessed are you, Adonai, for allowing me to light these candles. May you allow me to light the Hanukkah candles many times in your city, Jerusalem, with my wife, Avital, and my family and friends. This time, however, inspired by the sight of Osen standing meekly at attention, I added in Hebrew, and may the day come when all our enemies who today are planning our destruction will stand before us and hear our prayers and say, Amen. Amen, Osen echoed back, not having understood a thing. Then he sighed with relief, sat down, and removed his hat. For some time, we looked silently at the burning candles. I returned to the barracks in a state of elation, and we made tea and merrily celebrated the end of Hanukkah. Naturally, I told them about Osen's conversion, and it soon became the talk of the camp. I realized that revenge was inevitable, but I also knew that they had plenty of other reasons to punish me. Sharansky, of course, would come to embody the movement to free Soviet Jewry, in which many of us proudly took part. Often as Hanukkah approaches, I look back at this poignant episode in Sharansky's life, the courage of this 5-foot giant of Jewish history in the struggle for religious liberty can be likened only to that of the Maccabees, who fought the same fight against the Syrian Greeks more than 2,000 years before. But this year, I took out Sharansky's memoir a little early. A month ago, I had come across a fascinating article by Ira Stoll, a former editor of both The Forward and The Jerusalem Post, and now author of a new book, JFK Conservative, released in anticipation of this 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. The article highlights two lesser-known aspects of Kennedy's relationship with the Jewish community. The first was that he considered the Jewish community's successful integration into American society a model for other minorities to emulate, and especially admired the Jewish community's focus on education as the key to that success. These sentiments were actually captured in a taped conversation with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the height of the civil rights movement. But the second lesser-known fact about Kennedy's presidency was his concern for the plight of Soviet Jews. Stoll writes that when the leaders of American Jewry first urged the State Department to engage the Kremlin on the issue, they were generally, if sympathetically, ignored. Even such figures as Justice Arthur Goldberg and Senators Abraham Ribicoff and Jacob Javits had been frustrated in their efforts to convince Secretary of State Dean Rusk to act. But after Kennedy's friend, Boston attorney Louis Weinstein, approached the president in 1963, the president condemned the Soviet closing of synagogues in his remarks to the UN General Assembly that fall. And then he instructed Ambassador Harriman to raise the issue with Khrushchev directly during an arms control negotiation in Moscow. You know, it's getting pretty bad, Weinstein told Kennedy. There are murder trials going on. They call them economic trials, but the defendant is always a Jew. He's charged with black market trading or something else like that, and he's always convicted and executed. Weinstein informed the president that the Soviets had stopped virtually all Jewish emigration, and he reminded Kennedy that no American president had done a thing for Russia's Jews since the days of Theodore Roosevelt. Kennedy reportedly answered, "Well, here's one president who's ready to do something." Kennedy instructed Weinstein to organize a meeting in Washington addressing the plight of Soviet Jewry to be convened in early December, shortly after his return from a trip to Dallas. Of course, that meeting with Kennedy never occurred. But in a significant way, through his concern captured in that 1963 UN address for human rights generally and Jewish suffering particularly, and through his embrace of such figures as Arthur Goldberg and our member Abraham Ribicoff, both of whom served in his cabinet, Kennedy did play an important, if indirect, role in the organization of a political effort in America to free Soviet Jewry. Goldberg would go on to convene the gathering Kennedy had envisioned, and the Soviet Jewry movement was born. Neither as Americans nor as Jews are we in search of reasons to honor the memory of John F. Kennedy on this terrible anniversary. But with Hanukkah, our festival of religious liberty, approaching, the 35th president's legacy can also be for us a candle to shine the path out of darkness for those around the globe still struggling against the Antiochuses of our day, be they in Bangladesh or in Syria. And learning from our history, we who have known the yoke of oppression and the miracle of freedom can hold that candle aloft and begin to light the way. Ken yehi ratzon, so may it be. Shabbat shalom.